They barricaded the dining room and set fire to the chapel wing, trying to draw attention. And three slammed a sharpening stone on the hand of Commander Cherrystone and broke every bone in his wrist, I bet. Five and six rang the bell, but the shepherds are too far away, and it all happened too fast. Two wrote messages and tried to tie them to the feet of your crows, but they wouldn't be liberated. They just kept roosting on the windowsills again, useless old things. Four had a great idea about boiling oil, but they couldn't get the flame high enough. Oh, it was a merry chase here for a day or two, but of course the soldiers won. Men always win. Nanny continued petulantly. And we all thought they'd ambushed you earlier to get you out of the way. You're the only effective one here, everyone knows that. They all think you're a witch. The townspeople told me that if you come back, you're to be in touch with the hamlet of Red Windmill down below the dam. You know the one. They seem to think you can rescue their royal family, such as they are. I told them it was misplaced trust, that you wouldn't be interested. But I promised to give you the message, so there it is. Elphaba strode back and forth. She pulled her hair from its customary knot and shook it out, as if trying to shake away what she was hearing. "And Chistery?" she said at last. "Cowering behind the piano in the music room, no doubt." "Well, this is a fine kettle of fish." She strode, she sat, she stroked her chin. She kicked Nanny's chamber pot and broke it. "What have I got?" she mumbled. "There's the broom, there's the bees, there's the monkey, there's Killyjoy. Did they hurt Killyjoy? There's Killyjoy, there's the crows, there's Nanny, there's the villagers, if they're unharmed. There's the questionable Grimmery. It's not a lot." "No, it's not," said Nanny, sighing. "Doom, doom, I say." "We can get them back," said Elfie. "We will." "Count Nanny in," said Nanny, "though I never did like those sisters, I'll tell you." Elfie clenched her fists and tried to keep from striking herself. "Lear gone, too," she said. "I came here to make my apologies to Sarima, and I lost Lear in the bargain. Am I good for nothing in this life?" Kiamo Ko was deathly still, except for old Nanny's labored breathing as she took a catnap in her rocking chair. Killyjoy thumped his tail on the floor, happy to see his mistress. The sky was broad and hopeless beyond the windows. Elphaba was tired herself, but she couldn't sleep, for from time to time she imagined she could hear the sound of water lapping against the sides of the fish well, as if the legendary underground lake were rising to drown them all. Part 5. The Murder and Its Afterlife. Afterward, there was a lot of discussion about what people had thought it was. The noise had seemed to come from all corners of the sky at once. Journalists, armed with the thesaurus and apocalyptic scriptures, fumbled and were defeated by it. A gulfy deliquescence of deranged and harnessed air. A volcano of the invisible, darkly construed. To the pleasure-faithers with tick-tock affections, it was the sound of clockworks uncoiling their springs and running down at a terrible speed. It was the release of vengeful energy. To the essentialists, it seemed as if the world had suddenly found itself too crammed with life, with cells splitting by the billions, molecules uncoupling to annihilation, atoms shuddering and juggernauting in their casings. To the superstitious, it was the collapsing of time. It was the oozing of the ills of the world into one crepuscular muscle, intent on stabbing the world to its core for once and for all. To the more traditionally religious, it was the blitzkrieg of vengeful angel armies, the awful name of the unnamed god sounding itself at last, surprise, and the evaporation of all hopes for mercy. One or two pretended to think it was squadrons of flying dragons overhead, trained for attack, breaking the sky from its moorings by the thrash of tripartite wings. In the wake of the destruction it caused, no one had the hubris or courage, or the prior experience, to lie and claim to have known the act of terror for what it was. A wind twisted up in a vertical braid. In short, a tornado. The lives of many Munchkinlanders were lost, along with square miles of topsoil from hundreds of years of cultivation. The shifting margins of sand in the eastern desert covered several villages without a trace, and no survivors were left to tell the tale of their suffering. Whirling like something from a nightmare, the wind funnel drove into Oz, 30 miles north of Stonespar End, and delicately maneuvered around Colwyn grounds, leaving every rose petal attached and every thorn in place. The tornado sliced through the corn basket, devastating the basis of the economy of the renegade nation, and petered out, as if by design, not only at the eastern terminus of the largely defunct yellow brick road, but also at the precise spot, the hamlet of Center Munch, where, outside a local chapel, Nessa Rose was awarding prizes for perfect attendance at religious education classes. The storm dropped a house on her head. All the children survived to pray for Nessa Rose's soul at the memorial service. Perfect attendance was never more perfect. There were a great many jokes about the disaster, naturally. "You can't hide from destiny," some said. "That house had her name on it." That Nessa Rose, she was giving such a good speech about religious lessons, she really brought down the house. Everybody needs to grow up and leave home sometimes, but sometimes home doesn't like it. What's the difference between a shooting star and a falling house? One, which is propitious, grants delicious wishes. The other, which is vicious, squishes witches. What's big, thick, makes the earth move, and wants to have its way with you? I don't know, but can you introduce me? Such a maelstrom had not been known in Oz before. Various terrorist groups claimed credit, especially when news got around that the Wicked Witch of the East, also known as the Eminent Throp, depending on your political stripe, had been snuffed out. It was not widely understood at first that the house carried passengers. The mere presence of a house of exotic design, set down almost intact upon the platform rigged up for the visiting dignitaries, was stretching credulity enough. That creatures might have survived such a fall was either patently unbelievable or a clear indication of the hand of the unnamed god in the affair. Predictably, there were a few blind people who suddenly cried, "I can see!" A lame pig that stood and danced a jig, only to be led away, that sort of thing. The alien girl, she called herself Dorothy, was by virtue of her survival elevated to living sainthood. The dog was merely annoying. When the news of Nessa Rose's premature death arrived at Kiamo Ko by carrier pigeon, the witch was deep in an operation of sorts, stitching the wings of a white-crested male roc into the back muscles of one of her current crop of snow monkeys. She had more or less perfected the procedure, after years of botched and hideous failures, when mercy killing seemed the only fair thing to do to the suffering subject. Fiyero's old schoolbooks in the life sciences from Dr. Nicodick's course had given some leads. Also, the grimoire had helped, if she was reading it correctly. She had found spells to convince the axial nerves to think skyward instead of treeward. And once she got it right, the winged monkeys seemed happy enough with their lot. She had yet to see a female monkey in her population produce a winged baby, but she still had hopes. Certainly they had taken better to flying than they had to language. Chistery, now a patriarch in the castle menagerie, had plateaued at words of one syllable, and still seemed to have no clear idea of what he was saying. It was Chistery, in fact, who brought the pigeon's letter into Elphaba's operating salon. The witch had him hold the fascia slasher while she unfolded the page. Shell's brief message told of the tornado and informed her of the memorial service, which was scheduled for several weeks later, in the hope that she would receive this message in time to come. She put the message down and went back to work, placing grief and regret away from her. It was a tricky business, wing attachment, and the sedative she had administered to this monkey wouldn't last all morning. Chistery, it's time to help Nanny down the stairs, and find Lear if you can, and tell him I need to talk to him at lunch, she said through her gritted teeth, glancing again at her own diagrams to make sure she had the overlapping of muscle groups in the correct arrangement, front to back. It was an achievement if Nanny could now make it to the dining room once a day. That's my job, that and sleeping, and Nanny does both very well, she said every single noontime when she arrived, hungry from her exertions on the stairs. Lear put out the cheese and bread and the occasional cold joint, at which the three of them hacked and nibbled, usually in an unsocial mood, before darting off to their afternoon chores. Lear was 14, and insisted he was going to accompany the witch to Colwyn Grounds. "I have never been anywhere except that time with the soldiers," he complained. "You never let me do anything." "Someone has to stay and take care of Nanny," said the witch. "Now there isn't any point in arguing about it."
"Chistery can do it."
"Chistery can't. He's getting forgetful. And between him and Nanny, they'd burn the place to the ground." "No, there's no more discussion about it, Lear. You're not going. Besides, I'm going to have to travel on my broom, I think, to get there in time."
"You never let me do anything."
"You can do the washing up."
"You know what I mean."
"What's he arguing about now, sweet thing?" asked Nanny loudly.
"Nothing," said the witch.
"What's that you say?"
"Nothing."
"Aren't you going to tell her?" said Lear. "She helped raise Nessa Rose, didn't she?"
"She's too old. She doesn't need to know. She's 85. It'll only upset her."
"Nanny," said Lear, "Nessie's dead."
"Hush, you useless boy, before I remove your testicles with my foot."
"Nessie did what?"
screeched Nanny, looking roomily out at them.
"Did, died, dead," intoned Chistery.
"Did what?"
"Nessy died," said Lear.
Nanny began to weep at the idea before she had even confirmed it.
"Can this be true, Elfie? Is your sister dead?"
"Lear, you'll answer for this," said the witch. "Yes, Nanny, I cannot lie to you. There was a storm and a building collapsed. She went very peacefully, they say."
"She went straight to the bosom of Lurlina," said Nanny, sobbing. "Lurlina's golden chariot came to take her home."
She patted the piece of cheese on her plate inexplicably. Then she buttered a napkin and took a bite.
"When do we leave for the funeral?"
"You're too old to travel, dear. I'm going in a few days. Lear will stay and look after you."
"I will not," said Lear.
"He's a good boy," said Nanny, "but not as good as Nessa Rose. Oh, sorrowful day! Lear, I'll take my tea in my room. I can't sit and talk to you as if nothing's happened."
She hauled herself to her feet, leaning on Chistery's head. Chistery was devoted to her.
"You know, darling," she said to the witch, "I don't think the boy is old enough to see to my needs. What if the castle is attacked again? Remember what happened the last time you went away."
She made a small accusatory moo.
"Nanny, the Arjiki militia guard this place day and night. The wizard's army is well housed in the town of Red Windmill down below. They have no intention of leaving that safe haven and risking decimation in these mountain passes, not after what they did. That was their skirmish. That was their campaign. Now they're just watchdogs. They staff the outpost to report signs of an invasion or trouble from the mountain clans. You know that. You have nothing to fear."
"I'm too old to be taken in chains like poor Sarima and her family," Nanny said. "And how could you rescue me if you couldn't get them back?"
"I'm still working on that," said the witch into Nanny's left ear.
7 years! You're very stubborn. It's my opinion they're all moldering in a common grave these 7 long years. Lear, you have to thank Lurlina that you weren't among them."
"I tried to rescue them," said Lear stubbornly, who had rewritten the escapade in his own mind to give himself a more heroic role. It was not longing for the companionship of soldiers, he told himself. No, it was a courageous effort to save the family. In fact, Commander Cherrystone, out of kindness, had had Lear tied up and left him in a sack in someone's barn to prevent their having to incarcerate him with the others. The commander had not realized Lear was a bastard son of Fiero, for Lear himself didn't know it.
"Yes, well, that's a good boy."
Nanny was now distracted from the sad news, drifting back to the tragedy she remembered more viscerally.
"Of course, I did everything I could, but Nanny was an old woman even then. Elfie, do you think they're dead?"
"I could find out nothing," said the witch, for the 10,000th time. "If they were spirited to the Emerald City, or if they were murdered, I could not tell. You know this, Nanny. I bribed people. I spied around. I hired agents to follow every lead. I wrote to the Princess Nastoya of the Scroll for advice. I spent a year following every useless clue. You know this. Don't torture me with the memory of my failure."
"It was my failure, I'm sure," said Nanny peacefully.
They all knew she didn't think so for a minute.
"I should have been younger and more vigorous. I'd have given that Commander Cherrystone a piece of my mind. And now Sarima is gone, and her sisters too. I suppose it's none of our fault, really," she concluded disingenuously, scowling at the witch. "You had some place to go, so you went. Who can criticize you for that?"
But the image of Sarima in chains, Sarima as a decaying corpse, still withholding from the witch her forgiveness for Fiero's death, it pained her like water.
"Give up, you old harridan," said the witch. "Must my own household whip me so? Go have your tea, you fiend."
The witch sat down at last and thought of Nessa Rose and what might come. The witch had tried to stay removed from the affairs of the political world, but she knew a change of leadership in Munchkinland could throw things out of balance, maybe to a positive effect. She felt a guilty lightness at the death of her sister. She made a list of things to bring with her to the memorial service. Foremost was a page of the grimoire. In her chamber she pored over the huge musty tome, and finally she ripped out an especially cryptic page. Its letters still continued to contort beneath her eyes, sometimes scrambling and unscrambling as she looked, as if they were formed by a colony of ants. Whenever she gazed at the book, meaning might emerge on a page that a day earlier had been illegible chicken scratches, and meaning sometimes disappeared as she stared. She would ask her father, who, with his holy eyes, would see the truth better. Colwyn Grounds was draped in black swags and purple bunting. When the witch arrived, she was greeted by a one-man-less-than-welcoming committee, a bearded Munchkinlander named Nip, who seemed to be concierge, janitor, and acting prime minister. "Your lineage no longer allows you any particular liberties in Munchkinland," she was told. "With the death of Nessa Rose, the honorific of eminence is at last abolished." The witch didn't much care, but she wasn't inclined to accept a unilateral dictum without a retort. She answered, "It is abolished when I accept that it is abolished." Not that the honorific had been used much in recent years. According to the occasional rambling letter from Frex, Nessa Rose had begun to be amused by the slur of Wicked Witch of the East, and had considered it a public penance worthy of a person with such high moral standing. She even took to referring to herself as such. Nip showed her to her room. "I don't need much," said the Wicked Witch of the West, as in contrast she allowed herself to be called, at least by these Munchkinlander upstarts. "A bed for a couple of days, and I'd like to see my father and attend the service. I'll collect a few things and be off soon. Now, do you know if our brother Shell will be here?" "Shell has disappeared again," said Nip. "He left his regards. There is a mission he is undertaking in the Glickus. It can't wait. Some of us think he is defecting, worried about a change in government here now that the tyrant is dead. As well he might," he added coldly. "Have you fresh towels?" "I don't use them," said the witch. "It's all right. Go away now." She was very tired and sad. At 63, Frex was even balder and his beard whiter than he had been last time. His shoulders hunched in as if trying to meet each other. His head sank into a natural cavity made by a deteriorating spine and neck. He sat covered by a blanket on the veranda. "And who is this?" he said, when the witch came up and sat next to him. She realized his sight had nearly gone for good. "It is your other daughter, Papa," she said, "the one that's left." "Fabula," he said, "what will I do without my pretty Nessa Rose? How will I live without my pet?" She held his hand until he fell asleep and wiped his face, though his tears burned her skin. The liberated Munchkinlanders were destroying the house. The witch had no use for frippery, but it seemed a shame to waste a property this way. Desecration was so short-sighted. Didn't they know that, however they now decided to live, Colwyn Grounds could be their Parliament building? She spent time with her father, but they didn't speak much. One morning, when he was more alert and energetic than usual, he asked her if she really was a witch. "Oh, well, what's a witch? Who has ever trusted language in this family?" she replied. "Father, will you look at something for me? Will you tell me what you see?" She withdrew from an inner pocket the page from the grimoire, and she unfolded it like a large napkin on his lap. He ran his hands over it, as if he could pick up meaning through his fingertips, and then held it near, peering and squinting. "What do you see?" she asked.
Can you tell me the nature of this writing? Is it for good or for ill?
The markings are crisp enough and large. I ought to be able to make it out. He turned it upside down. But, little Fabula, I can't read this alphabet. It is in a foreign tongue. Can you?
Well, sometimes I seem to be able to, but the talent is fleeting, said the witch. I don't know if it's my eyes or if it's the manuscript that's being tricky.
You always had strong eyes, said her father. Even as a toddler, you could see things no one else could.
Ha! She said. I don't know what you mean.
You had a looking-glass that sweet Turtle Heart made for you, and you looked in it as if you could see other worlds, other times.
I was probably looking at myself.
But they both knew that wasn't true, and Frex for once said so. You didn't look at yourself, he said. You hated to. You hated your skin, your sharp features, your strange eyes.
Where did I learn that hate? She asked.
You were born knowing it, he said. It was a curse. You were born to curse my life.
He patted her hand affectionately, as if he didn't mean much by this.
When you lost your weird baby teeth, and your second teeth came in normally, we all relaxed a little. But for the first couple of years, until Nessarose was born, you were a little beast. Only when saintly Nessarose was delivered to us, even more scarred than you, did you settle down like a normal child.
Why was I cursed to be different? She said. You are a holy man, you must know.
You are my fault, he said.
Despite his words, he was somehow pinning blame on her instead of himself, though she still wasn't clever enough to see how this was done.
For what I failed to do, you were born to plague me. But don't worry yourself about it now, he added. That's all long ago.
And Nessarose? She asked. How do the weights and balances of shame and guilt account for her?
She is a portrait of the lax morals of your mother, Frex said calmly.
And that's why you could love her so much, said the witch, because her human frailty wasn't your fault.
Don't stew so. You always stewed, Frex said. And now she is dead, so what does it matter?
My life is still running on.
But mine is running out, he answered sadly. So she put his hand back on his lap and kissed him gently and folded up the page of the Grimoire and tucked it in her pocket. Then she turned to greet the person approaching them across the lawn.
She thought it was someone with tea.
Frex was still accorded a measure of service due to his age and his mildness and, she supposed, his vocation. But she stood and pressed down the front of her homespun black skirt when she saw who it was.
"Miss Glinda of the Arduenas," she said, her heart churring. "Oh, you came. I knew you would," said Glinda. "Miss Elphaba, the last true eminent Throp, no matter what they say."
Glinda approached slowly, either through age or shyness, or because her ridiculous gown weighed so much that it was hard for her to get up enough steam to stride. She looked like a huge glinderberry bush, was all the witch could think. Under that skirt there must be a bustle the size of the dome of St. Florick's. There were sequins and furbelows and a sort of history of Oz, it seemed, stitched in trapunto in 6 or 7 ovoid panels all around the skirting. But her face, beneath the powdered skin, the wrinkles at eyelid and mouth, was the face of the timid schoolgirl from the Pertha Hills.
"You haven't changed a whit," said Glinda. "Is this your father?"
The witch nodded, but shushed her. Frex had dropped off again. Come, we'll walk in the gardens before they root up the roses out of some benighted attempt at eradicating injustice. The witch took Glinda's arm. Glinda, you look hideous in that get-up. I thought you'd have developed some sense by now. When in the provinces, she said, you have to show them a little style. I don't think it's so bad. Or are the satin bells at the shoulder a bit too? Excessive, agreed the witch. Someone get the scissors. This is a disaster. They laughed. My dear, what they've done to this grand old place, said Glinda. Look, those pediments are meant to support graven urns, and those revolutionary slogans are painted all over that exquisite belvedere. I hope you'll have something done, Elfie. There isn't a belvedere to match that outside of the capital. I never had the love of architecture that you did, Glinda, said the witch. I just read the slogans. She walked all over us. Why shouldn't they paint all over her belvedere, if she did, in fact, walk all over them? Tyrants come and go. Belvederes are forever, said Glinda. I can recommend top-notch restorers the moment you ask. I hear you were one of the first on the scene, said the witch, when Nesserose died. How did that come to be? Sir Chuffrey, my hubby, he has some investments in pork futures, you know, and Munchkin Land is trying to diversify its economic base so as not to be at the mercy of Gillikin Banks and the Emerald City Corn Exchange. You never know what relationship might develop between Munchkin Land and the rest of Oz, and it's best to be prepared. So where Sir Chuffrey does business, I do good. It's a partnership made in heaven. You know, I have more money than I can give away. She giggled and squeezed the witch's arm. I never imagined that doing public charity would provide such a rush. So you were here in Munchkin Land? Yes, I had been at an orphanage on the shores of Mossmere, and for a lark I thought I'd go to the game park. They have dragons there now. And I'd never seen a dragon, so I was scarcely a dozen miles away when the storm hit. We had terrible winds even there. I cannot imagine how a ceremony could have been in progress in Center Munch. In Mossmere, there were whole sections of the park closed to visitors due to the fear of falling trees and escaping animals. Oh, so they call it a game park with animals, said the witch. You must go, dear, it's a lark. Well, as I was saying, the house came right out of the blue, and I suppose I mean that literally. If they'd sensed a big storm, they'd surely have cancelled the event and run for cover. Anyway, the news system is very advanced now in parts of Munchkin Land. Nesserose herself oversaw a system of beacons and tick-tock code signals to warn of invasions from the wizard and points west. So it was only a matter of minutes before the news was being flashed in all directions. I commandeered a mature phoenix and asked her to bring me to Center Munch, and I arrived before most of the locals had quite figured out what had hit them. "Tell me about it," said the witch. "You'll be pleased to hear there was no blood. I venture to guess there were massive internal injuries, but there was no blood. Of course, Nesserose's last few devoted followers thought this meant her spirit was taken up intact, and that she suffered little. I don't imagine she suffered much, not with that kind of clonk on the noggin. Her more unhappy subjects, who were the greater in number, thought it a droll act of Lurlina, releasing them from Nesserose's particular sort of fundamentalist bondage. There was revelry when I arrived, and much fetting of the funny girl and the dog who seemed to have lived in the house. "Oh, who's that?" said the witch, who hadn't heard this part. "Well, you know how Munchkin Landers bow and scrape, no matter what their democratic inclinations. No sooner had I arrived than they deferred to me, introducing me as a witch. I tried to correct them. A sorceress is really much more apt, but never mind. It was no doubt the outfit. It cowed them. I was in a salmon-pink fantasy that day, and really it suited me.
"Go on," said the witch, who had never liked talking about clothes.
Well, the child introduced herself, Dorothy from Kansas. I didn't know the place, and said as much. She appeared as much surprised as anyone else about what had happened, and she had a nasty little pooch yapping about her heels, Tata or Toto or something. Toto. So this Dorothy was in some state of shock, I can tell you. A fairly homely little girl with little fashion sense, but I suppose that comes later in life for some than others.
She glanced sideways at the witch.
Much later in some cases.
And they both chuckled at that.
Dorothy supposed she should try to get back to her home, but as she couldn't remember having studied anything about Oz in school, nor could I recall a place named Kansas, we decided that she should look for help elsewhere. The fickle Munchkinlanders seemed ready to nominate her as Nessie's successor, which would have angered Nip and all those ministers in Colwyn Grounds, who've spent their careers jockeying for position when and if Nessa Rose ever saw fit to die. Besides, there may be other developments afoot. Dorothy might have gotten in the way.
An eye to public affairs. Well, somehow I'm not surprised, said the witch. In fact, quite pleased.
I always knew you were in there somewhere, Glinda. Well, I thought the better move would be to get Dorothy out of Munchkinland before a civil war tore this place up even worse than it already is. There are factions, you know, who support the reannexation of Munchkinland by Oz. It would do the girl no good to get caught in the crossfire of opposing interests.
Oh, so she's not here, said the witch. I had thought I'd meet her.
Dorothy? Now, you're not going to take against her, are you? Said Glinda. She's a child, really. Big by Munchkinlander standards, of course, but a squat little thing nonetheless. She's an innocent Elfie. I can see by the gleam in your eye that you're up to your old paranoia thing again. She wasn't piloting that house, you know. She was trapped in it. This would be one struggle you'd do well just to leave alone.
The witch sighed.
You may be right. You know, I'm getting used to stiff muscles in the morning. Sometimes I think that vengeance is habit-forming, too. A stiffness of the attitude. I keep hoping that the wizard will be toppled in my lifetime, and this aim seems to be at odds with happiness. I suppose I can't take on avenging the death of a sister I didn't get on all that well with anyway.
Especially if the death is an accident, Glinda said.
Glinda, said the witch, I know you must remember Fiero, and you have heard of his death 15 years ago.
Of course, said she.
Well, I heard he died under mysterious circumstances.
I knew his wife, said the witch, and his in-laws. It was suggested to me once that he had been carrying on an affair with you in the Emerald City.
Glinda turned yellow-pink.
My dear, she said, I was fond of Fiero, and he was a good man and a fine statesman. But among other things, you will remember he was dark-skinned. Even if I took up dalliances, an inclination I believe rarely benefits anyone, you are once again being suspicious and cranky to suspect me and Fiero. The idea!
And the witch realized, sinkingly, that this was, of course, true. The ugly skill at snobbery had returned to Glinda in her middle years. But for her part, Glinda had no real inkling that the witch was implicating herself as Fiero's adulterous lover. Glinda was too fussed to listen that closely. The witch, in fact, alarmed her a little. It was not just the novelty of seeing her again, but the strange charisma Elphaba possessed, which had always put Glinda in the shade. Also there was the thrill, basis indeterminable, which made Glinda shy and caused her to rush her words and to speak in a false high voice like an adolescent. how quickly you could be thrown back to the terrible uncertainty of your youth. For when she chose to remember her youth at all, she could scarcely dredge up an ounce of recollection about that daring meeting with the wizard. She could recall far more clearly how she and Elfie had shared a bed on the road to the Emerald City, how brave that had made her feel, and how vulnerable, too. They walked for a way in a restless silence. "Things might begin to improve now," said the witch after a time. "I mean, Munchkin Land will be a mess for a while. A tyrant is terrible, but at least he or she imposes order. The anarchy that follows the deposition of a tyrant can be bloodier than before. Still, things may work out all right. Father always said that when left to themselves, the Munchkinlanders had a great deal of common sense. And Nessie was, for all practical purposes, a foreigner. She was raised in Quadling country, and, you know, she may have been half Quadling herself, I've come to realize. She was a foreign queen on this soil, despite her inherited title. With her gone, the Munchkinlanders might just right themselves." "Bless her soul," said Glinda. "Or do you still not believe in the soul?" "I can make no comment on the souls of others," said the witch. They walked some more. Here and there the witch saw, as before, the totemic straw men pinned to tunics and erected like effigies in the corners of fields. "I find them somewhat creepy," she said to Glinda. "Now, one other thing I want to ask you. I asked this of Nessa once. Do you remember Madame Morrible's corralling us into her parlor and proposing we become three adepts, three high witches of Oz, sort of secret local priestesses shaping public policy behind the scenes, contributing to the stability or instability of Oz as required by some unnamed higher authority?" "Oh, that farce, that melodrama, how could I forget it?" said Glinda. "I wonder if we were put under a spell then. Do you remember? She said we couldn't talk about it, and it didn't seem that we could." "Well, we are talking about it, so if there was any truth to it, which I doubt, it's certainly worn off by now. But look what's happened to us. Nessa Rose was the Wicked Witch of the East. You know that's what they called her. Don't pretend to be so shocked. And I have a stronghold in the West, and I seem to have rallied the Arjikis around me by dint of the absence of their ruling family. And there you are, sitting pretty in the North, with your bank accounts and your legendary skills at sorcery." "Legendary nothing. I simply see to it that I am admired in the right circles," said Glinda. "Now, my memory is just as good as yours, and Madame Morrible proposed that I be an adept of Gillikin, but that you be an adept of Munchkinland, and Nessa be an adept of Quadling country. The Vincas she didn't think worth bothering about. If she was seeing the future, she got it wrong. She got you and Nessa all wrong." "Forget the details," said the witch tartly. "I just mean, Glinda, is it possible we could be living our entire adult lives under someone's spell? How could we tell if we were the pawns of someone's darker game? I know, I can see it in your face. Elfie, you're sniffing conspiracy theories again, but you were there. You heard what I heard. How do you know your life hasn't been pulled by the strings of some malign magic?" "Well, I pray a lot," said Glinda. "Not terribly genuinely, I admit, but I try. I think the unnamed God would have mercy on me, and give me the benefit of the doubt, and release me from a spell if I had accidentally fallen under one. Don't you? Or are you still so atheistic?" "I have always felt like a pawn," said the witch. "My skin color's been a curse. My missionary parents made me sober and intense. My school days brought me up against political crimes against animals. My love life imploded and my lover died. and if I had any life's work of my own, I haven't found it yet, except in animal husbandry, if you could call it that.
I'm no pawn, said Glinda. I take all the credit in the world for my own foolishness. Good gracious, dear, all of life is a spell. You know that. But you do have some choice.
Well, I wonder, said the witch. They walked on. Graffiti was splattered on the sides of the granite plinths of statues.
Now the shoes on the other foot. Glinda tisk-tisked.
Animal husbandry, she said.
They crossed a little bridge. Bluebirds twinkled music above them like a sentimental entertainment.
I sent this Dorothy, this girl, on to the Emerald City, said Glinda. I told her I'd never seen the wizard. Well, I had to lie. Don't look at me like that. If I told her the truth about him, she would never have left here. I told her to ask him to send her home. With his reconnaissance spies all over Oz, and no doubt elsewhere, he has heard of Kansas, I'm sure. Nobody else has.
That was a cruel thing to do, said the witch.
She's such a harmless child. No one should take her seriously, said Glinda carelessly. If the Munchkinlanders started rallying around her, reunification might be a more bloody affair than we all hope.
So you hope for reunification, muttered the witch, disgusted. You support it.
Besides, Glinda went on blithely, having some motherly instinct somewhere inside this pushed-up bosom of mine, I gave her Nessa's shoes as a sort of protection.
You what?
The witch whirled and faced Glinda. For a moment she was dumb with rage, but only for a moment.
Not only does she come whomping out of the sky and stepping her big clumsy house all over my sister, but she gets the shoes, too? Glinda, those shoes weren't yours to give away. My father made them for her, and furthermore, Nessa promised I could have them when she died.
Oh, yes, said Glinda in a false calm, surveying the witch up and down. And they would make the perfect accessory for that glass-of-fashion outfit you have on. Come on, Elfie, since when have you cared about shoes of all things? Look at those army boots you have on.
Whether I'd wear them or not is none of your concern. You can't go handing out a person's effects like that. What right had you? Papa reshaped those shoes from skills he learned from Turtleheart. You've stuck your fancy wand in where it wasn't wanted.
I'll remind you, said Glinda, that those shoes were coming apart until I had them resold, and I laced them through with a special binding spell of my own. Neither your father nor you did that much for her. Elfie, I stood by her when you abandoned her in Shiz, as you abandoned me. You did, don't deny it. Stop those lightning bolt looks at me, I won't have it. I became her surrogate sister. And as an old friend, I gave her the power to stand upright by herself through those shoes. And if I made a mistake, I'm sorry, Elfie, but I still feel they were more mine to give away than yours.
Well, I want them back, said the witch.
Oh, put it behind you, will you? They're only shoes, said Glinda. You're behaving as if they're holy relics. They were shoes, and a bit out of style, truth be told. Let the girl have them. She has nothing else.
Look how the people here thought of them, said the witch. She pointed to a stable on which was scrawled in broad red letters, Walk all over you, you old witch.
Please give it a rest, said Glinda. I have such a headache coming on.
Where is she? Said the witch. If you won't retrieve them, I'll get them myself.
If I'd known you wanted them, said Glinda, trying to make things all right, I'd have saved them for you. But you have to see, Elfie, the shoes couldn't stay here. The ignorant pagan Munchkinlanders, Lurlinists all, once you scratch the skin, they had put too much credit in those silly shoes.
I mean, a magic sword I could understand, but shoes? Please. I had to get them out of Munchkinland. You are working in collusion with the wizard to render Munchkinland ready for annexation, said the witch. You have no agenda of charity, Glinda. At least don't fool yourself. Or are you really under some rusty spell of Madame Morrible after all this time? I won't have you snapping at me, said Glinda. The girl has left. She's been on the road for a week now. She headed west. I tell you, she's only a timid child and means no harm. She'd be distressed to know she'd taken something you wanted. There is no power in them for you, Elfie. The witch said, Glinda, if those shoes fall into the hands of the wizard, he'll use them somehow in a maneuver to re-annex Munchkinland. By now they have too much significance to Munchkinlanders. The wizard mustn't have those shoes! Glinda reached out and touched the witch's elbow. They won't make your father love you any better, she said. The witch pulled back. They stood glaring at each other. They had too much common history to come apart over a pair of shoes, yet the shoes were planted between them, a grotesque icon of their differences. Neither one could retreat or move forward. It was silly, and they were stuck, and someone needed to break the spell, but all the witch could do was insist, I want those shoes! At the memorial service, Glinda and Sir Chuffrey perched in the balcony reserved for dignitaries and ambassadors. The wizard sent a representative, resplendent in his dress reds, with the emerald cross marking quadrants on his chest, a crew of bodyguards at attention all around him. The witch sat below and did not meet Glinda's eyes. Frex wept until he brought on an attack of asthma, and the witch helped him out a side door, where he could catch his breath. After the service, the wizard's emissary approached the witch. He said, You have been invited to an audience with the wizard. He is traveling by special diplomatic immunity via a phoenix to offer his condolences to the family this evening. You will be prepared to meet him at Colwyn Grounds this evening.
He can't come here, said the witch. He wouldn't dare.
Those who now make the decisions think otherwise, said the emissary. Be that as it may, he comes under cover of darkness, and only to speak to you and your family.
My father is not up to receiving the wizard, said the witch. I won't have it.
He will see you then, said the emissary. He insists. He has questions of a diplomatic nature to put to you. But you are not to make this visit public, or it could go very hard on your father and your brother, and on you, he added, as if that were not already evident. She considered how she might use this command audience to her own advantage. Serima, the safety of Frex, the fate of Fiero.
I agree, she concluded. I will meet him.
And despite herself, she was glad for a moment that Nessarosa's magicked shoes were safely out of the vicinity. As the vesper bells rang, the witch was summoned from her room by a Munchkinlander maid. You will have to submit to a search, said the wizard's emissary, meeting her in an antechamber. You must understand the protocol here. She concentrated on her fury as she was probed and prodded by the officers who ringed the waiting area. What is this? They said, when they found the page of the grimoire in her pocket.
Oh, that, she said, thinking fast. His Highness will want to see that.
You can bring nothing in with you, they told her, and they took the page from her.
By my bloodlines, I can reinstate the office of the eminent Throp tonight and have your leader arrested, she called after them. Do not tell me what I can and cannot do in this house.
They paid her no mind, and ushered her into a small chamber, bare but for a couple of upholstered chairs set upon a flowery carpet. Along the baseboards, dust mice rolled in the draft.
"His Highness, the Emperor Wizard of Oz,"
said an attendant, and withdrew. For a minute the witch sat alone. Then the wizard walked into the room. He was without disguise, a plain-looking older man, wearing a high-collared shirt and a greatcoat, with a watch and fob hanging from a waistcoat pocket. His head was pink and mottled, and tufts of hair stuck out above his ears. He mopped his brow with a handkerchief and sat down, motioning the witch to sit too. She did not sit. "How do you do?" he said. "What do you want with me?" she answered. "There are two things," he said. "There is what I had come here to say to you, and then there is the matter of what you bring to my attention." "You talk to me," she said, "for I have nothing to say to you." "There is no point in beating around the bush," he said. "I would like to know your intentions about your position as the last eminence."
"Had I any intention," she said, "it would be none of your business."
"Ah, alas, it is my business, for reunification is under way," said the wizard, "even as we speak. I understand that Lady Glinda, bless her well-meaning foolishness, has sensibly evacuated both the unfortunate girl and the totemic shoes from the district, which should make annexation less troublesome. I should like to have those shoes in my possession, to prevent their giving you ideas. So you see, I need to know your intentions in the matter. You were not, I take it, in warm sympathy with your sister's style of religious tyranny, but I hope you do not intend to set up shop here. If you do, we must strike a little bargain, something I was never able to do with your sister."
"There is little for me here," said the witch, "and I am not suited to govern anyone, not even myself, it seems."
"Besides, there's the small matter of the army at, is it Red Windmill, the town below Kiamo Co?"
"So that's why they've been there all these years," said the witch.
"To keep you in check," he said. "An expense, but there you are."
"To spite you, I should reclaim the title of eminence," said the witch. "But I care little for these foolish people. What the Munchkinlanders do now is of no interest to me, as long as my father is left unharmed. If that is all..."
"There is the other matter," he said. His manner became more lively.
"You brought a page with you. I wonder where you got it." "That is mine, and your people have no right to it."
"What I want is to know where you got it, and where I can find the rest."
"What will you give me if I tell you?"
"What could you want from me?" This was why she had agreed to meet him. She drew a deep breath and said,
"To know if Sarima, Dowager Princess of the Arjikis, is still alive, and where I might find her, and how I might negotiate her freedom."
The wizard smiled.
"How all things work together. Now isn't it interesting that I could guess of your concern?" He waved a hand. Unseen attendants outside the open door ushered in a dwarf in clean white trousers and tunic. No, it wasn't a dwarf, she saw. It was a young woman crouching. Chains sewn into the collar of her tunic ran through her clothes to her ankles, keeping her bent over. The chains were only 2 or 3 feet long. The witch had to peer to see for sure that it was Nor. She would be 16 by now, or 17, the age that Elfie had been when she went up to Crage Hall at Shiz.
"Nor," said the witch. "Nor, are you there?"
Nor's knees were filthy, and her fingers curled around the links of her bondage. Her hair was cut short, and welts were visible beneath the patchy tresses.
She tossed her head as if listening to music, but she would not shift her gaze toward Elphaba.
"Nor, it's Auntie Witch. I've come to bargain for your release at last," said the witch, improvising.
But the wizard motioned the unseen attendants to usher Nor out of sight. "I'm afraid that is not possible."